go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order for the afternoon session. It is at 2:52 PM Wednesday, March 12, 2008. With me today is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Huggins, Senator Elton, Senator Dyson. The other two members are in the building, most likely just waylaid with other committee work. We're going to have four bills this afternoon. We're going to take up the first bill, Senate Bill 289, Home Energy Conservation. We'll have initial hearing today. We'll set that bill aside and bring it up at a future date, most likely tomorrow morning. And then we'll go on to House Bill 260, State Officers Compensation Commission, House Bill 120, Unemployment Compensation Benefits, and Senate Bill 246, Susitna Hydro Working Group Report. And with that, I'd like to start off with Senate Bill 289, Energy Conservation. And we'll hear from the prime sponsor, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've introduced Senate Bill 289 to address energy needs throughout the state of Alaska. And I have Dr. John Wise to make a presentation for the committee to go over the initial legislation.
Okay. Dr. Wise, if you could introduce yourself and who you represent, and then go ahead and do the presentation.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is John Wise. I'm on staff to Senator Hoffman. I'd like to thank the committee for its expeditious hearing of this bill. I have a brief PowerPoint presentation that I'd like to give at this time, and then see if there's any questions in the audience. We have Mr. Dan Fauske, Director of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and Brian Butcher. I'm not sure if anyone is online. I'm told yes, there are AHFC representatives online if there's questions. You should have the presentation also in your packets. We started this bill by taking a look at the housing situation in Alaska with the idea of meeting the energy needs from the low-income perspective. From a survey completed in 2005 by Information Insights, it was estimated that in 2005 there was almost 280,000 housing units in the state of Alaska. They also found that the percent of older housing, that is those houses 21 years or over, was increasing, and the percent of new housing less than 10 years was decreasing. Household income for weatherization, the households that were eligible for weatherization services, which is explained at 60% of median income, roughly was 45,000. And the number of households report being drafty was 45%, or almost half of the houses in Alaska consider draft as a problem. With that, we proposed in Senate Bill 289 to work with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to be more responsive to Alaskans being impacted by the high energy costs. This bill updates and expands the home energy efficiency and the weatherization programs within AHFC. It focuses on energy efficient improvements and directs available funding to items that will save the most energy. We want to be cost effective on this, and not spending money if it's not going to show a payback. Typical improvements that AHFC will do is air sealing, insulating, or improving the water or heating heaters used in homes. After meeting with AHFC, we proposed to do a two-prong approach to helping Alaskans with their high energy costs. The first was to focus on the weatherization program that they've been carrying on for a number of years. And in that program, it's a grant program available to low-income Alaskans at the 60% median level. We propose to raise that to at least 100% median However, low-income Alaskans will continue to receive priority focus from AHFC. Basically, median income at 60% for a family of one is almost $24,000. Up to a family of five would be $53,286. That continues on at $1,378 each additional person. 100% median would be almost $40,000 for family of one. Family of five would be almost $89,000 income.
We've been joined by Senator Olson and Senator Thomas. Please continue.
The impact of Senate Bill 289, in past years, AHFC roughly was spending $4.8 million a year, $1.8 million federal sources, and $3 million AHFC source funding. And they were able to help 600 households or 1,700 people. At first, we thought moving up the amount of money 10 times, if you went to a $48 million program with 60% median, you'd help 4,167 households, 11,800 people. If you recall from the survey we did of how many houses in Alaska needed weatherization help at the 60% median income, it was estimated there were 45,000 households eligible for that. So clearly the a little over 4,000 households here, $48 million was not enough funds, I think, for us to meet the needs that were out there in Alaska. So we proposed adjusting median to 100% and requesting $200 million in funds, which would be able to help over 17,000 households, 49,000 people in the state. We believe that would be significant, and across the state, the relief that Alaskans, I think, are calling for would come. The second program, the second prong of, in the two-prong approach that we proposed was to work with the Home Energy Rating Rebate Program. In that program, homeowners, it's not a grant program. You would have to either self-finance or get a loan. And the first thing that would happen is someone from AHFC or their representatives would come out and do an energy audit on your home and recommend what the best things to do on a cost-benefit ratio that would help with your energy costs. And then they would come out and do a post-assessment, and the amount of money that you spent to do the retrofit in your home, you would be able to get a rebate on that from $2,500 to $5,000 as you improve the ENERGY STAR ratings in a step approach. So the first step, you would get a $2,500 rebate, and each additional step after that, you'd get roughly a $500 increase to a maximum $5,000 rebate. It's expected from past research on Alaska Housing Finance working with homes to improve their energy efficiencies, 30% reduction in home energy costs. Once again, the maximum rebate, $5,000. The state investment would be $100 million, and because homeowners would be putting in more money and getting the rebate off of that, the estimated investment for homeowners would be at least $175 million. So this part of the program to the state would bring out $275 million, $100 million being the state portion. Briefly, in summary, Senate Bill 289 is improved and more flexible process for AHFC to respond to the rising fuel costs out there. Existing programs, specifically the two I mentioned, would be more responsive, would broaden their scope, and would allow them to help more Alaskans. In your bill packets, you have the sponsor statement, the bill, and a sectional analysis completed by legal. Basically, what the bill does is does cleanup language, removing two programs no longer in existence, and adds energy on page 3 of the bill. Line 6 adds energy efficiency and deletes low income, because we would be moving from 60% to 100% median income. there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer them, or representatives of AHFC.
Could you give us a, this is an existing program, could you give us a brief synopsis of when the program started, and maybe the department may want to come forward for that, when the program started, and a little 1.5 minute burst on the success of it in the past?
Mr. Chairman, good afternoon. My name is Dan Fauske. I'm CEO of Alaska Housing Finance Corp. I have people online. I'm going to take a guess, but I've been there going on 15 years. Gee, 14, almost 15. I think it's been around for 20 years, the weatherization program, and it might be longer than that. Any folks, Bob Breen or Mike Buller, are you online?
We have a Scott Waterman and a
yes.
Kerry Boylan.
That'd be fine, sir.
Scott Waterman, Valdez. The weatherization program was started in 1978, and the home energy rebate program was in existence for from 1992 to about 1995, when the funding ran out, and it has not been reauthorized for funding since that point.
And how many years has it gone underfunded?
Mr. Chairman, we have, as you will see and have would probably remember, in our capital budget is a line item for weatherization that we have utilized for many years. It generally, I think this year the request is $6 million. It's generally funded at between 3.5 to 6, or would be requested of that high. In past years, it has always been an area that that line item would always remain, but it would be reduced by a certain amount as the needs of the state were determined by either governor's office or legislators. And so it was never fully funded at generally the requested amount. And I'm not saying that in an adversarial way. It was just the way we were, you know, things had to be done as we, and you folks directed funds. It has always been an area where we have advocated that it's a great program, continued use, and probably in hindsight would have fought harder for it if we thought oil would have gotten to $109 a barrel. And I think none of us can be held accountable. We're all, I think, in the same boat, Mr. Chairman, that the weatherization program, as effective as it has been, has truly become effective. When you look at $100 oil, $109 oil today, I think close 10 cents away from $110. We've seen presentations by a gentleman named Jim Lee, who runs interior weatherization, where an investment of $3,500, I think I have the number correct, it's minimal to weatherize a house in simplistic terms, some insulation in the attic, some weather stripping, some caulking around windows, maybe a new door, caulking around some of the vents and stuff like that, can generate savings of up to a 50% internal rate of return on your investment with a payback of 18 months at $100. Oil. It used to be a good investment anyway and would have an internal rate of return of way 20 to 25%, but with these increased costs, so families are seeing savings of $300 to $500 a month on their utility bills with a minimum amount of work. And in light of this program, unless you're getting into boiler replacements or more technical stuff, a lot of this work is can be done by the homeowner themselves or in good fashion by contractors and others. It's most of it is fairly routine, and so this, I hope I've answered your question, Mr. Chairman, but it's been a long-standing program and has had a great deal of impact on a lot of people in the state.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The other factor to this appropriation or this legislation is that at a time when housing construction is down, you know, I believe that there are construction companies that can fill the void and get the projects done, and I wonder if Mr. Fauske can address that point as well.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, certainly I met recently with the Home Builders Association. We've got an ongoing program going on in reference to the subprime market and the lending issue in the state and our ability to get better information on there as to the status of the housing market, which we can deal with later on if you so desire. Prior to even this bill being introduced and the amount of money that's being discussed, there was an interest by the homeowners or home builders to some of them that whose business activities were shifting from a lot of new construction. They were already starting to look at remodels and or retrofits under the existing program because it was a way that they could keep their people working. It was an area of expertise that they were quite comfortable in. And so there's been a great deal of excitement on behalf of the home builders to work towards doing a lot of this work, which is right up their alley, along with the regional housing authorities and the others that are already participating statewide in this program.
We have any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
We'll go ahead and we have no one on the off yet on this bill, but we've got a few people in the audience that want to come forward. Kate Troll. And introduce yourself and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Stedman. My name is Kate Troll. I represent the Alaska Conservation Alliance, which is a statewide umbrella organization representing about 40 conservation groups with a combined membership of 38,000 Alaskans. And I'm here to testify in support of 289. You need to know that within our organization, energy issues have risen to the forefront and are a priority concern for us. And while there's many reasons for that, one of the paramount reasons is the energy crisis in rural Alaska and the inordinate prices that they're having to pay for fuel and heating oil. And so we look at 289 is at its core, it is a responsible action to the energy crisis in rural Alaska. We applaud Senator Hoffman and others for introducing it. The other thing that I want to highlight is that there are many states and utilities that have implemented energy conservation and efficiency programs around. And by and large, the experience shows that for every $1 invested in energy programs like that's proposed here in 289, there's generally a savings of $2 to the homeowners. So energy efficiency and conservation are basically the cheapest way to meet energy demands. It's the low-hanging fruit, and in fact, some energy experts have coined the term negawatts, which means a watt of energy that wasn't created due to energy efficiency. So the cheapest way to generate megawatts is negawatts, if you will. So 289 does that. I also want to highlight the fact that in the report that was prepared by Information Insights to the Cold Climate Housing Research Center, it noted that just doing the weatherization program for about 45,000 households statewide, if two-thirds of these homes were weatherized, we in Alaska would see more than 1 billion pounds of avoided carbon emissions and a present savings of $227 million. That is significant. And I just was reading through this report earlier today, and it's an interim report. And very rarely have I ever testified where I see an interim report and then the legislature is already acting on three of its key recommendations. So I really applaud the foresight that is represented in 289. And lastly, I just want to emphasize that 289 and energy efficiency conservation is the first prong of dealing with our energy demands and needs. It is, you know, provides that short-term assistance, which is needed. The other aspect is investing in renewable energy, and that's House Bill 152. So I'm encouraging you to look at both of these as a package that helps build toward a clean, secure energy future for Alaska, and that you will pass and fund both of them. And I think it would be a tremendous step forward to addressing Alaska's rising energy crisis. And my last comment was one made by Senator Hoffman, and that this is also about jobs. You know, as we have a downturn in home construction and remodeling, up retrofits, weatherization will create more jobs at a time when it's very much needed. So with that, I'll end my comments and be available if there are any questions.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Megan Wagner. Welcome to Senate Finance. Ms. Wagner, if you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then tell us what you think of the bill. I think this is your first time here in the room, or the first time testifying to a committee, is that correct?
Correct. Well, the Senate Finance one, correct. My name is Megan Wagner, and I don't represent anyone but myself and my opinions, and so no entity or organization. But today I would like to testify in support of Senate Bill 89. It is increasingly important for homes to be more energy efficient, and I feel that as policymakers, you now have the opportunity to provide affordable home weatherization and affordable home efficiency. The subsidy provided by the state, if approved, would be an excellent incentive for many Alaskans to start looking more at their energy habits and to start increasing their energy efficiency within their homes and with their families. Rural communities would benefit most from this appropriation, I believe, and it's already been brought up, the increasing oil prices that we are all affected by everywhere, and especially in rural Alaska. And I think if we are provided this allocation and this funding for home weatherization and efficiency, we can start looking more at our habits and reducing our consumption of fossil fuels and start to look more at what we're doing as people and as families. And so I guess the only thing I can ask is for your support of 289 and the allocation both for home efficiency but also for the weatherization. Okay. Thank you for your time and your work.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, Madeline Seidler, better known as Bee Queen Seidler, is that right? You can introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. My name is Madeline Seidler, and I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 289. I belong to a generation that's beginning more and more to value responsible resource consumption and to value energy efficiency. And I think home energy efficiency is a keystone issue in this movement. I think we have a responsibility and a duty, not just to ourselves, but to our future, to conserve the resources that we have and to start looking at them more wisely. And I think Senate Bill 289 will give people around the state the needed incentive to use their home energy wisely and to become aware of what they use. And in effect, I think they'll witness the tremendous financial benefits that come with this awareness. I think Senate Bill 289 is a tremendous step in the right direction to a more sustainable energy future. And I'd like to thank you for your continuing hard work.
Thank you for your testimony. That concludes the sign-up. Is there anybody that happened to pop in that wants to speak on this bill? Seeing none, we have nobody on the off-net. That's non-departmental people. Senator Hoffman, do you have any final comments before we set this bill aside?
No final comments, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Set this bill aside and bring it back, scheduling tomorrow. And with that, we're at ease for probably 45 minutes to wrap up a couple of budgetary items, and then we'll be back to continue our bill work. We're at ease. We got House Bill 260, State Officers' Compensation, up. The intent is to have a brief hearing on this bill and refer it to a subcommittee for additional work. We'll not take public testimony today. There will be an opportunity for public testimony when the bill comes back from the subcommittee, and the subcommittee is not created to make the bill disappear. I'll work with the subcommittee chairman to make sure that we have enough time when it comes back that we get action by the full committee. And with us present the bill today as Representative Dugan from the other body. And Rep. Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Introduce yourself and who you represent and walk us through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Mike Dugan. I represent House District 25, although on this side of the building, I think I should say I represent half of Senate District M. House Bill 260 is an attempt to reestablish a compensation commission modeled on one that was in effect in the state of Alaska in the late 1970s, which is actually the last compensation system that we ever had that worked in terms of the legislature. As a matter of fact, Senator Elton was a civilian member of that compensation commission, Mr. Chairman. This bill, also there's a few repealers in it that would take out what is now in the law, which was a 1986 law that established another compensation commission contingent upon the passage of a constitutional amendment, which never passed. So when you see the repealers, that's what they're about. The bill would establish a commission of five citizen members, all appointed by the governor. One of those members would be appointed from a list presented by the Speaker of the House. One of the members would be from a list presented by the President of the Senate. The other three would be essentially at-large members. None of those members can have served in a position over which the commission has authority for the previous 4 years. That means that in this case, for instance, a former legislator could serve, but only after they've been out of office for 4 years. The bill covers legislators, the governor, the lieutenant governor, and the heads of the principal departments, the commissioners. It's staffed by the Department of Administration, and I believe in your packet you'll find a fiscal note for about $7,500. The law requires the commission to report at least every 2 years. It doesn't require them that report actually change compensation. It's simply that they review compensation, and if they decide everything's okay, all they have to do is say everything's okay. The recommendations of the commission take effect unless they're specifically rejected by the legislature. This is a provision that we found in dealing with the local boundary commission, and if members will recall that it was the initial position of the administration on the AGIA bill was they wanted to set it up so that we only had disapproval authority. The legislature retains essential authority over what happens to compensation because it does require a specific appropriation to fund it. The last point I think I want to make, Mr. Chairman, is that this is not an arrangement that's peculiar to Alaska. In your packets, I believe that you'll find a PowerPoint presentation that was made by a gentleman named Carl Kurtz from the National Council of State Legislators that talked both about legislative compensation and about the fact that there are roughly 20 compensation commissions of various authorities now at work in the United States. And with that, as I said, I'll just stop and see if I can answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Haven't had much time to read some of the attached material. I understand the bill and support it, and there is a legal services memorandum in here citing some cases, and I'm not quite sure I understand the upshot of that, and if the bill has addressed that, I guess, is the question. And the legal memorandum, you got it?
Okay. Yeah, if I might, through the chair, Senator Thomas, in the House State Affairs Committee, Representative Coghill raised the question of whether it would be more proper to have this piece of legislation says they present us a bill, essentially, and which we then have to approve. He asked the question of whether or not it should be a resolution instead. We asked the legal department to give us an opinion. That opinion says it should, in fact, be a bill rather than a resolution, and that's what that says.
Okay. Thank you.
The sunset issue. Should we have this reoccurring this commission meet every 10 years, or it's not sunsetted, or what's your thoughts on
Mr. Chairman, it's my hope that this continues into infinity if it works, and if it doesn't, we just take it out of the statute. I don't, you know, if it works the way the first commission did and doesn't run afoul of some of the problems that the second commission had, then it would be simply a matter of having it continue and probably have new people cycle through it as the appointments change. Frankly, I don't see any reason to set this commission up and put a sunset on it, because if it isn't working, we'll know long before any reasonable sunset date. And if it is, I don't think we want to sunset it. So,
Senator Hoffman, question.
And yes, I do have a question. I see that you have the, as you stated, the recommendations of the commission would take effect unless otherwise rejected by the legislature. That includes the first recommendation?
Yes, Senator, it does.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have any other comments for the committee?
I'm going to say something, and it's an assumption, and you can tell me whether my assumption is right. When you speak about an executive department head, you're speaking of commissioners. You're not necessarily speaking of the director of OMB or some of the other people that are cabinet-level officers.
Through the chair, Senator Relt, my understanding is that's the language they use to mean commissioners when they write it. My instructions to the drafter were commissioners, and I'm assuming that that's what I got back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, seeing no further questions, and fiscal note already been mentioned, so a small fiscal note. At this time, I'm going to go ahead and refer this to a finance subcommittee to review this matter and then come forward to the full commission. And we're going to have Senator Elton chair that. We're going to have Senator Olson and Senator Dyson sit on that. And I've asked Senator Elson to get back to the full committee by the 28th of March. I'll keep us posted if there's any issue. Senator Elton and myself have had several conversations on this matter over the past, I don't know how many months, several months. And we at the table were preparing to put in a finance committee bill to address this issue. Some of us feel that there's a thread of commonality between some of the improprieties that have taken place in and around this building and the salary structure. So I'm glad to see Rep. Dugan and you have also have thought it was an issue and worked at it from a different angle, but you know, I'm interested in the solutions. I'm willing to work with you. With that, we'll go ahead and...
I have one other question.
Senator Hoffman.
For us that have been around a long, long time, is there any retroactive provisions?
Depends on how you treat us.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, I want to tell you that I wanted to get a provision in there as a retroactive compensation for those of us who used to write about you, but they told me I just couldn't do it. So,
with that, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside, and thank you for your time, Dugan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
I'm sure Senator Elton will have numerous conversations with you.
I look forward to it.
Senate Bill 120 is next, Unemployment Compensation Benefits. The intent here is to hear from the sponsor, take some public testimony, and set this bill aside. The bill is sponsored by the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. The chairman is with us today, Senator Ellis. He's here to present the bill. And Senator Ellis, if you can introduce yourself and who you represent, and then speak to the bill, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Johnny Ellis, State Senator representing Midtown and Downtown Anchorage, and I really appreciate you. I know you folks are very busy, and I appreciate the time to make this initial presentation of Senate Bill 120. Mr. Chairman and members, this bill is the result of a year-long stakeholders process conducted in the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. numerous intense work sessions with business groups, labor advocates, Department of Labor experts, staff, and committee members. I want to first begin by quickly making the case for the bill, making some points about the UI system, and then we have some charts that are very illustrative of what the current situation is and what the proposed situation would be under this piece of legislation. Mr. Chairman, the healthy unemployment insurance system benefits all Alaskans, and it does so in this way. Unemployment insurance provides a shock absorber for businesses, individuals, and families hit by economic change. Unemployment insurance helps both businesses and workers. It helps local economies, local small businesses. When someone's out of work, they have to have some ability to maintain, and that benefits the local economy. Alaskan workers then stay in Alaska ready for jobs when business picks up. We're hoping to have a gas pipeline in the future. We'd like to stabilize the Alaska workforce and have those Alaskan workers remain in state, so employers maintain a stable, ready pool of experienced workers. Mr. Chairman, Alaska's unemployment insurance system has been soundly managed, and the folks that have been responsible for this deserve a big gold star. The system has been managed very well and conservatively managed those funds. Alaska has never depleted its trust fund, even in the downturn of 1986. Other states have depleted their trust funds during times of economic stress and required bailouts. Never with us, very conservatively and well managed. Alaska's UI system has always been able to maintain payments even during those economic crises in our past. Another important consideration is wage replacement. The unemployment insurance system seeks to replace 50% of lost wages, and in fact is capped in statute at 50%, a goal repeatedly confirmed by presidents, commissions over many decades in the United States. Alaska's wage replacement rate is dead last among all states. It's not often that we get to say that we're the worst, but in this regard, we are. Alaska's wage replacement rate is 25.8% in 2005 and has likely gotten worse, but these are the most current statistics available. Alaska's benefit amount has fallen far behind wages. Our maximum weekly benefit amount of $248 is the fourth lowest in the nation, and I would ask each member to think about whether you could subsist on that amount of money. Alaska's maximum weekly benefit amount has not been adjusted since 1997. We're between 11 and 12 years in any adjustment. Eligible wages are capped at $26,500. One-third of Alaskan wage earners earn that much or more, but are limited to the $248 in weekly benefits. Another important point, Mr. Chairman, is that tax rates are low. Now is the time to raise the benefit amount. Alaska's 2008 UI tax rates are the lowest in 20 years, and Governor Sarah Palin, with great fanfare and a press release and public statements, brought that to our attention, that the tax rate for employers will be the lowest in 28 years. That's a good economy, that's good management, and it makes it very timely to consider this bill. So there is room to raise the benefit to the $370, which represents a restrained, compromised weekly benefit amount. You could make the case for a significantly higher benefit rate, but we've settled on the 370 as a dynamic tension between advocates for unemployed workers and the business community. Senate Bill 120 would raise the average employer cost $25 per employee from the 2008 level. The total out-of-pocket cost to employers would remain $89 below the 2007 level. So $89 below the 2007 level, and that will become more clear when we get to the charts. The employee cost will rise $37 per year over the 2008 amount. So, Mr. Chairman, the Labor and Commerce Committee substitute, we intended to do the bulk of the work there and get this bill in the best shape possible to come to the Finance Committee. So the Labor and Commerce Committee bill represents a compromise. Benefits need to be raised. Most reasonable people agree with that statement. Employers view the system as too costly, and that was a prime consideration that our committee took into account. The businesses were complaining about the overall cost of business, the high cost of energy, a lot of things beyond the control of our committee or even the entire Alaska state government. But we were very sensitive to the bottom line, because a number of our members, myself included, have been small business people trying to make things balance and meet the bottom line. So there was a great sensitivity to that. And so we made this bill a compromise that shifted the burden. Currently, employers pay 80% under the existing system, the status quo, and employees pay 20%. Under this bill, the employers would pay 73%. We're going from 80% to 73% of the relative burden for the employers. That's a great break. And going from 20% to 27% for employees. Now, the fact of life here with these economics are that this is a significant shift, and recognizing the burden on the employers. For an individual employee, you know, a lot of folks aren't comfortable with this shift from the employer to the employee. I think we've gotten it up to the tolerance level of advocates for the unemployed. But most individual employees will not really notice. You know, it's a big deal to the employers. It's a significant deal, but not a deal breaker for the employee with the money that would be coming out of their check. Alaska is one of only two states that actively mandate employee contributions. New Jersey is the other. Most states don't require employees to pay anything. The state of Alaska does, along with New Jersey. And New Jersey's maximum weekly benefit is $536 per week. Alaska's is $248. This bill would raise it to the $370 we've discussed. I personally believe, and this bill includes an automatic inflation-proofing mechanism, I believe that that is important to keep up with economic reality, to avoid having to do this every 5, 10, 12 years. But I absolutely understand and respect the opinion of many legislators and their right to jealously guard the ability of the legislature to make these adjustments in school funding amounts or in UI. I would prefer to have automatic inflation proofing, but that, of course, is left to your good judgment. Then if the bill remained the same in that regard, the legislature would not have to visit this contentious issue every year. And I believe, Mr. Chairman, well, actually, this is absolutely essential, that Alaska must enact the confidentiality statutes in this bill. The first eight sections are the confidentiality statutes to bring us into compliance with federal law. Federal law requires that all states protect UI data by October of 2008. Failure would mean a loss of $19.1 million in federal funds to the state Department of Labor, and Alaska businesses would be responsible for an additional $87 million in taxes if we do not update our statutes in regard to confidentiality. So that is absolutely essential. Mr. Chairman, I want to conclude my part of this presentation and ask committee staff Dana Owen to go over the charts, the essential charts that are there in your packet, because they really illustrate the important points.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Dana Owen, staff to Senator Ellison to the Labor and Commerce Committee. In your packets, in your backup packets, you have a series of charts that begin with one that looks like this. And it says at the top, unemployment insurance maximum weekly benefit amount by state. And it graphically illustrates where our maximum weekly benefit amount falls in relation to the other states. We are 48th, or fourth from the bottom, as Senator Ellis has already pointed out. And I would point out that the other state that has that also has an employee contribution to the UI tax system, New Jersey, is third from the top at $536 a week. On the next chart, Alaska's minimum weekly benefit is a stair-step chart that simply illustrates the history of raises in the UI benefit amount since 1966. And you'll see that the $248 rate was last achieved in 1997, and you'll notice that this is the longest period of time that we have been since 1966 without raising the rates. The next chart, page is a table. And I should point out that some of these charts will have a large number up in the corner like this one does, number two. These charts were originally published in the February 2007 edition of State's Economic Trends, published by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. I highly recommend the article to you if you want a brief overview of the UI system. This chart, labeled number two, is, or this table labeled number two, simply shows the effect of the amendment that happened in 1997. It also gives you an overview of the range of amounts that you would earn under the UI system. As you can see, the maximum rate is by no means the only rate that you can have. The two columns on the left give you the benefit, the qualifying amounts to get the benefit. The column on the right shows you the benefit that you would get at that amount. The next page, number four, labeled number four, is Alaska Unemployment Insurance Recipients by Weekly Benefit Amount. And what that illustrates is that we have the largest proportion of UI recipients are people who have already maxed out at 248. We're 32.7% of all recipients get the maximum amount of benefit. The next page, labeled number five, Average Wage Replacement Rates, is an illustration of where we stand to others in regard to other states in the amount of wages that we replace with our maximum benefit. You'll notice that at the bottom is Alaska. We are at 25.8%, far below any of the other states. On page six, or the next chart, labeled number six, we have some replacement rates for Western states. For some of our neighbors, you notice that Idaho, Montana, Utah, for instance, are all up above 40%, at 40% or above, while we remain the lowest of those Western states. The next chart, chart seven, the target gets farther away. And again, that's an illustration of what happens when we raise the rate. Year by year, the amount that we get in a benefit diminishes in terms of the amount of wages that it actually replaces. The following table, called Average Weekly Benefit Amounts as a Percentage of the Average Weekly Earnings, based on 2006 data, is simply a summary of what we've already discussed. You can see that the average weekly benefit amount, we rank 48th at $197.63. And as a percentage of earnings, we rank 50th. The next two charts are ones that I particularly want to call your attention to. The next chart, the estimated annual unemployment insurance employee tax cost with maximum weekly benefit amount increased, tax share ratio changed, and minimum qualifying wage raised, is what is presented in the Labor and Commerce version of Senate Bill 120. That is to say, the bill that you have before you. These are the employee rates, and you'll see that in 2008, the current maximum employee rate is $157. That would rise to $194 by the time that the rate phases in 2013. The result is a $37 increase in employees' share of, or in the employee payment. The next chart is the effect on the employer taxes. And here you see that in 2007, the estimated annual cost per worker for the average employer, well, I suppose in 2007 it probably wasn't an estimate. I assume that that number is a hard figure at $584. In 2008, that number drops dramatically to $470. It continues to decline until 2010, at which point the effect of Senate Bill 120 begins to come in, and you'll see that it begins to increase again. And as Senator Ellis pointed out, that when it's fully in effect by 2013, the cost of $495 is still dramatically below what employers were paying just last year. And Mr. Chairman, that's the end of the charts that we have for you today.
Business groups actually asked us, Mr. Chairman, to phase this in, and that's exactly what we've done with the legislation. So to sum up, the figures are clear. In my opinion, this is long overdue. It's a reasonable, well-crafted compromise. It's nearly cost neutral. That's what the business community was asking for. They asked actually for some structural changes that were either illegal under federal law or untenable, ungettable. Some things that just we couldn't go backwards on in terms of labor law. But so what we tried to do is shift the money to send millions of dollars back to the employers to charge a little more of the individual employee to make a rough balance and get toward the goal that the business community wanted of cost neutrality. And we nearly got to cost neutrality. We bent over backwards and got very, very close. And finally, this is the right time. When the rates are the lowest in 28 years, it's still a struggle to be in business and to meet the bottom line, but this is a reasonable compromise that gets us toward the goal of a stable workforce and reasonable benefits for folks who need it when they're unemployed. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your time very much this afternoon.
Questions for the bill sponsor. And with that, we're going to go to Anchorage and David Ruiz. Ruiz?
Sir, that's me, David Ruiz.
Go ahead and speak to the bill, please. Go ahead and identify yourself again for the record, though, and so make sure we get, because I know I've mispronounced your name, and I apologize for that, but then go ahead and speak to the bill.
Yes, my name is David Ruiz, and I am member of Labor 341. I'm here to, I would like to express our support for the SB 120. The current maximum rate of $248 has not been adjusted in 11 years. We have the lowest average wage replacement in the nation at 25.8%. More than the New Jersey, we are the only state that requires employees to pay into unemployment trust. Just as a point of reference, New Jersey pays a maximum of benefit of $536. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. That's what we'd like, short and brief and to the point. Larry Brink, please.
Yeah, my name's Lawrence Brink. I worked at Matanuska May Dairy for better than 20 years. I was in the $21 an hour bracket, and then when they closed the business, I went down to much less than that. This $248 doesn't cover my space rent, electric, gas, or telephone. I didn't really check into it before I was on the street, but gosh, you add in groceries and fuel and health insurance, and pretty soon your savings account's gone. The COBRA payment we had was $1,800 a month when we were discharged. I was one of the lucky ones. Union negotiated me a pretty good severance package. But someone who doesn't get that, they're not going to make it till the next job. They're going to run out of money in a hurry, and they're going to leave out of here. Thank you for your time, and any help you can give us is appreciated.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Elsa Bing, Billingham.
Hi. Yes, my name is Elsa Billingham. I'm a member of Public Employees Local 71, and we would like to support Senate Bill 120 for the following reasons. Alaska is the only state in the nation besides New Jersey that requires employees to pay into an unemployment trust. New Jersey's maximum unemployment benefit is $536 a week, while Alaska has stagnated at the 1997 level of $248 per week. Our average wage replacement is the lowest in the nation. This is a measure that will help keep Alaskans in Alaska. With the cost of oil increasing, simply heating the homes of the unemployed has become prohibitive at current maximum benefit level, not to mention the price increases to all aspects of life. Raising the current maximum benefit as proposed in Senate Bill 120 will act to simply keep the heads of the unemployed above water. But we are upset in the increase of the employee contribution. We are only one of two states in the nation contributing like this. To rate is going from 20% to 27%. Also, I would like to object to the way the state treats people who have been terminated from their employment and not allowing them to collect unemployment and having to wait an additional 5 to 6 weeks to collect unemployment. I am a past state employee. I had worked at Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport at Airfield Maintenance. I was terminated from my job for backing into a stop sign. There was not a scratch on my pickup. I did $51 worth of damage to a stop sign. I was subjected to retaliation, harassment, and so forth because of backing into the stop sign, and they put some additional charges on me. The supervisors that I had, they had also had accidents also. They were not subjected to the same type of punishment I was. I filed with the Human Rights Commission. After that, I was blacklisted by the Department of Transportation. I can no longer find employment. And I feel that this retaliation against me is unfair, and I feel that the state of Alaska should not be subjecting average people, average working people who are just trying, making just enough money to get by month to month as it is. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Yep, thank you for your testimony, and sorry to hear about your plight. Mr. Wayne Stevens. Mr. Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Wayne Stevens, President, CEO of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. For the past 4 years, the State Chamber has been an active participant in the unemployment insurance legislation discussion. As written, committee substitute for Senate Bill 120 from Labor and Commerce will raise weekly benefits for unemployed workers with little cost increase to employers. In fact, in the final year of the bill's gradual implementation process, it is likely the cost for unemployment insurance to the employer will be less than what we pay today. The bill has gone through multiple iterations, not published with the Senate Secretary. Senator Ellis, the bill's sponsor, has had many stakeholder meetings looking at nearly every aspect of increasing or reducing costs to employers and employees while aiming to raise the weekly benefit rate. I offer our thanks to Senator Ellis for all of his hard work and that of his staff. Current weekly benefit rates are very low for Alaska's high cost of living labor market. Maintaining a trained workforce in Alaska to fill seasonal jobs or to provide necessary labor for large construction jobs will likely have the net result of helping Alaska's businesses. When employees enter layoff periods, raising unemployment insurance weekly benefit amounts, as prescribed under Senate Bill 120, should help maintain a stronger Alaskan workforce. The weekly benefit amount hasn't gone up in some 12 to 15 years, but the annual cost to business has continued to rise each and every year. The maximum taxable rate has gone from $19,200 some 12 or 15 years ago to this year, a rate of $31,300. While the tax rate has maintained a flat application, the maximum taxable wage has gone up. So not unlike your property assessment, the assembly tells you the tax rate has stayed the same, but the assessed value has continued to rise every year. So the cost to business has continued to rise, even though the weekly benefit amount has not gone up. We offer our support to the bill. Feel the bill represents a painstakingly difficult process in finding a compromise with all parties of interest to the unemployment insurance issues. We feel there are still many outstanding issues that could save both the employer and employees more money in the long run. But as written, we do support the committee substitute for Senate Bill 120. Encourage the Finance Committee to take quick action with regards to the bill, as there are many provisions, specifically sections 1 through 8, that must pass this year in order for Alaska statutes to be in concurrence with newly passed federal provisions. If we don't pass that, we go right back to where we were with the FUTA dumping cases, and Alaska businesses will pick up the $118, $130 million cost that's currently covered by the federal government. I urge your support for Senate Bill 120 and appreciate the time. Thank you, members of the committee.
Testimony, Mr. Stevens. We do have a question from Senator Elton.
Thank you also, Mr. Stevens, for your testimony and for your support of the bill. And this may be a question better answered by staff, but I didn't think of it in time, and Mr. Stevens, you may know. One of the compelling charts that we have in front of us is a chart that looks at what the past cost per employee was to employers and then goes out to 2014. And does reflect a reduction from the 2007 experience. And I was wondering if these are inflation-adjusted dollars or 2008 dollars, or if they're, if, you know, because I mean, I would assume that the cost to the employer would be even less if they're not inflation-adjusted. Do you know?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, I am not familiar with the data sources from the Department of Labor and as to whether or not those were inflation adjusted. I'm assuming you're looking at the chart titled Estimated Annual Cost Per Worker for Average Employer.
I am.
Mr. Owen may be well better served to answer that question for you.
Bill sponsor is locked and loaded and ready to go.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my understanding that these are nominal dollars. They're not inflation adjusted, and people from the Department of Labor are here shaking their heads and indicating that that's the case.
So my understanding, Mr. Chair, is that the savings to the employer are even greater because we can assume that the value of the dollar 5 or 6 years hence is not going to be the same as it is now.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Stevens, for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That concludes the off-net. And we're going to bring it back into the room. We have two participants, Tom Bryce. You can identify yourself and who you represent and to the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing Senate Bill 120. My name is Tom Bryce. I work for the Alaska District Council of Laborers. We represent over 6,000 working Alaskans. We wanted to come out in support of SB 120, reiterating some of the comments that have been made earlier. We do support the increase. We are concerned about the perception that I think that we have is that we're having to buy the increase with the increase in employee contributions going from 20% to 27%. Aside from that, we do support this bill moving forward and encourage your efforts at keeping this moving.
Thank you. Thank you. Don Etheridge. Guys have probably been waiting for days in the hall to come in and talk to the committee. So.
We have. We missed you.
You could introduce yourself for the record and speak to the bill.
I'm Don Etheridge. I'm here on behalf of the Alaska State AFL-CIO. And we, too, are coming out in support of SB 120. We did reach a negotiated agreement on it, and most of the parties weren't happy, so I guess it was a pretty good agreement. If everybody leaves just about as unhappy on a piece of legislation, and we do support it as is.
Thank you. With everybody in the room, maybe we could have the bill sponsor come back to the table for final comments. And I'm just kind of curious, Senator Ellis, is there any groups that oppose the bill, or because we've got the chamber supporting it and we got organized labor supporting it?
Right. There were a couple of other participants in the stakeholder process. One is the National Federation of Independent Businesses. And they, I believe there's a letter available in your packet that is, you know, I'm hesitant to characterize things, but to me, my personal impression that it was very, very much toned down from what their initial impression of the bill would have been. So I thought we made a lot of progress there. Their representative, Mr. Denny DeWitt, had his chance to talk to the stakeholders group and the committee. There are some folks, Mr. Chairman, that, and I'm not ascribing this necessarily to National Federation of Independent Business, but there are people who do believe that unemployment insurance really shouldn't exist, or that actually the national position of NFIB is that it should be 100% employer funded, so that employees really wouldn't have a stake in the system to advocate for higher weekly benefits. That's their national position, as I understand it. So there was full participation by that organization. Their position in the past has been to sort of resist any kind of changes because of the overall cost of businesses. And as I said, we couldn't control, you know, the cost of energy and the cost of workers' comp and other things, insurance costs in this bill. We were strictly looking at unemployment insurance. So NFIB was a participant, and then some representatives from the tourism and hospitality industry were given a full opportunity to question the folks from the Department of Labor and work with the committee. Some of their structural suggestions were not able to do under federal law, or I could not get the votes together to change labor law, which the labor advocates perceived as going backwards and unacceptable, and just, you know, wanted to pull the plug on the whole thing if we were going to go backwards. And I met with those folks yesterday, and they may want to speak at some point in the process. They weren't up to speed on the current committee substitute. The hospitality industry was asking for a phase in of this proposal, and of course the nature of the bill is a phase in. And once they were aware of that and the shifting of millions of dollars from the employers to the employees in terms of relative share of the responsibility for the system, they agreed that we were going in the right direction, and were very pleased with the direction of the bill, and we're going to go off and think whether they could support the bill or remain neutral on the bill. So the engagement process with the business folks, representatives of the business community in Alaska, has been intense, and this is our work product for your consideration.
And how long was the bill worked on in committee?
It was a year.
About a year.
A year of effort.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, also, I just received a letter in the last couple of days from the AGC. I wouldn't characterize it as overwhelming support. It's lukewarm support, but I can provide that to your committee staff.
Okay, if you could do that, I'd appreciate that. Okay, we'll go ahead, set this bill aside for a future date.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate your attention.
Take a brief at ease. We have one final bill today. It's the first hearing on an important issue. I wish the televised crew would have been here for this one. But this is Senate Bill 246, the Sitna Hydro Working Group Report. The intent here is to hear public or to hear testimony from the sponsor and take some public testimony and then set the bill aside. The bill sponsor, Senator Thomas, is going to go ahead and walk us through the bill. It's an issue that we've been struggling with in several different committee levels for two, three years. So with that, Senator Thomas, if you could walk us through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 246 directs the governor to have the Alaska Energy Authority analyze the hydroelectric potential of the Susitna River. There are studies that exist from the 40s and the 50s, actually, and we had another long study that was completed in the early 80s. The AEA is expected or will review and update the studies done in the past, evaluate cost analysis, financing options, current and future demand, and other critical issues to determine the feasibility of the project. The governor will submit a final report to the legislature no later than July 1st, 2010. In recent years, Alaskans have seen their energy costs skyrocket. There's ever-rising costs and uncertain supplies, not only making it difficult for Alaskans across the state to make ends meet, but also have an adverse impact on our economic growth. The energy produced by a hydroelectric facility is predictable, stable, clean, and low cost. Currently, the Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Dam produces energy for the rail belt at just 5 cents per kilowatt hour, far below the dollar or the 17 and a half cents per kilowatt hour that the interior is currently paying. In addition to these factors, the majority of our combustion turbine power plants along the rail belt are over 30 years old, and all will need retrofitting and replacement that will cost between $1 billion to $2.5 billion over the next 10 years. And that's a rather conservative estimate. Once these replacements begin, we will continue with the same rising energy costs, fluctuating operating expenses, and high polluting facilities that the citizens of the state have experienced in the past. 25 years ago, when a dam along the Susitna River was looked at, Cook Inlet gas cost 21 cents per million cubic feet. The population and energy demand along the rail belt was substantially less than today, and energy costs were nowhere near what they are today. I believe all these factors, along with the environmental and long-term energy considerations, merit a reopening of the Susitna study. Not only was gas cheap at that point, that's the same comparison you would make to today, even at a reduced rate, as we're lucky to have in the Cook Inlet, is $5.60 a thousand cubic feet, which is the Henry Hub equivalent. When they lopped off the study and shut down the project and abandoned it, they looked. We had less than $14 a barrel for oil at that point in time. So there's been a huge change. Now we're all aware of exactly what that amounts to in today's dollars. We're at $108 a barrel, I believe, was yesterday's price of a barrel of oil, $108 and some odd cents. And the Henry Hub price of gas is almost $10 a million BTUs or a million cubic feet. Like I said, they're equivalent numbers, basically. So I encourage you to take a serious look at this. It's a small amount of money, even though the fiscal note reflects what it does. That fiscal note is broken down into what tasks would be undertaken, not necessarily all of the money spent, if in fact someone if the AEA looked at it and said, well, we've done a couple of the tasks and we find that it's not necessarily a financeable project and not necessarily feasible, but the objectives in their work tasks are very well laid out in the attached fiscal note. And with that, myself or my staff or Grier Hopkins are ready, willing, and able to answer any questions you may have regarding the fiscal note or any aspects of the bill.
Senator Thomas, isn't this kind of a broader reaching energy analysis scope than just Susitna dam?
It's certainly, yes, Mr. Chairman, it actually does a fairly thorough analysis of what exists in the area, alternatives to it, so it doesn't just limit itself to a Susitna study because they're going to do a comparison for two other potentials in the rail belt, anyhow, that would compete with it potentially. So they plan to look at all of that, and with the new energy coordinator, I think it's very timely. We also have a big hill ahead of us with energy costs anyhow, and it's not going to get any better.
So the alternative, or the alternative is probably not a good phrase, comparative energy supply could come from things like a bullet line, imported LNG, gas fine strikes in Cook Inlet.
That's right. More usage of coal. Mm-hmm. Other potential hydro that exists in the rail belt that is at least accessible.
Okay. Senator Elton.
I have spent 13 years in the legislature trying not to think about the rail belt energy fund, but I'm wondering if that isn't a more appropriate source of dollars than general fund.
It could probably be. To me, I don't think the utilities and others might suggest that. I'm not sure that what the governor's approach might be. This was just something, this was a bill to get us going, get us thinking about it, and obviously had to have a fiscal note, so the money's there. It wouldn't bother me. I would be one that would suggest that that fund is appropriate, because that seems like a very good use of it for, because it certainly is there to benefit the utilities and the power structure in the rail belt, and that's exactly where we're talking about. That 70-some percent of the population exists right there in the rail belt.
And I think it also includes a look at the transmission lines, capacity.
That's correct.
Bottlenecks.
Yep. Updating of those. That's right. Yeah.
I think the comment about potential target fund source of the Rail Belt Energy Fund is something the committee should consider. But we can, you know, we can work on that. And the fiscal note does show there's $2.7 million in 2009-09 and followed up in 2010 by $1.5 million. Do we have any further questions to the bill sponsor before we go to the off-net? Okay, we're going to go to the off-net. We'll start with Steve Higginson from the Alaska Energy Authority. Steve Higginson, are you still online?
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 246. My name is Stephen Higginson, and I'm recently appointed statewide energy coordinator and executive director of the Alaska Energy Authority. Hydroelectric plants are known to provide stable-priced energy over long periods. The cost of energy is stable once construction is complete, as costs are mainly driven by the capital requirements of the dam and the generators. Determining an accurate cost estimate is critical. Sizing is also critical for the hydroelectric project, not only for the megawatt capacity, but also in identifying the available water resources to ensure a year-round power supply. Senate Bill 246 would take the next step to determine the proper size for the railroad energy system, both now and in the future. A 600-megawatt Susitna would serve the entire rail belt from Fairbanks to Homer. Using this capacity, I did a cost comparison of a 600-megawatt project, hydroelectric project in Susitna, to a 600 megawatts of new, highly efficient combustion turbines. This back-of-the-napkin analysis shows the yearly cost of debt service, operation and maintenance, and fuel for Susitna to be $259 million, or about 5 cents a kilowatt hour. The equivalent cost of the combustion turbines at about $501 million. This is a savings of about $250 million per year. We need to take the next step to identify in Senate Bill 246 to identify the savings which are realistic and can be achieved. Susitna will emit minimal CO2, where the turbines will emit 2.5 million tons of CO2 a year. Susitna will also reduce the Anchorage gas consumption by about 25 billion cubic feet of gas each year, or in a year. And the assumptions we used were realistic and reasonable, but need to be projected into the future and verified, so that the decision about Susitna can be made on an informed basis. Senate Bill 246 provides a detailed analysis of the Susitna hydroelectric project, and I urge your support of the bill. If the Sitna is constructed as a result of this bill, it will benefit the economy and the people of the state of Alaska for many generations to come. Thank you and this opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 246, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. I think some of the just real crude ballpark numbers we were using or were kicking around on our resources was 10 to 15 billion for the Sitna Hydro. Just to put it in perspective, but we'll have that stuff flushed out as we go forward with the study. See, the next guy is just for questions. Jerry McClutchin.
Mr. Chairman, there's no L in my name. It's MC, capital C, UTCHEON. We heated with electricity at 9 mils, 0.9 cents. Susitna was saddled with an inflation rate of 7% and an interest rate of 10%, which is a nightmare. And then Eric Yule added 25% on top of that to all the rest of the costs. If Sitna had been constructed when shelled and refinanced, the rail belt would now be enjoying power at 3 cents a kW. I'm testifying against the bill. I think it delays what needs to be done. And I'm surprised that Mr. Hagenson would even question the size of Susitna being oversized. It amazes me how many testifiers thank the chairman for allowing them to speak. I suppose it is to curry favor. The right to testify is a legal issue and is one of the first questions the court asks when legislation issues become before them. Was the public allowed to testify? Questions about by invitation only and making some people more equal than others have never been tested. It is very strange that the questions about Susitna, which could be answered with a phone call to a librarian at the Arliss Library, where most of Susitna's ES, IES, and other documents reside, are not asked of the librarian, but are used to generate contracts worth hundreds of thousands of dollars and total into the millions of dollars. Study money is the mother's milk of campaign contributions. Nothing converts campaign contributions like outside contractors and study money. The same thing is happened in Juneau 25 years ago. The study money plagiarist would bill the legislature for $200,000 to $250,000 for 4 hours' work and plagiarize the U.S. Forest Service documents. Strange when an go or no-go answer on Susitna is needed as soon as possible, not only so others can take action on the answer, which involves hundreds of millions of dollars, and also the failure to take action can cost millions of dollars, but also to take action when the political climate is favorable and will change within a few months. All of that is bypassed in favor of one that requires the commingling with other issues and requires considerable time and puts considerable money into a state organization, the Alaska Energy Authority, which misdesigned the water intake for Bradley Lake and who covers up their faulty engineering, which deprives Bradley Lake of 42% of Bradley Lake's peaking power by saying there's not enough water when in fact there is unused water. The same organization, the Alaska Energy Authority, that misdesigned the power lines to Fairbanks so they hang so low in the winter that they are so hazardous to snow machiners and hikers that they require a public announcement of the hazard almost every hour of every day. Despite repeated pleas that the Alaska Energy Authority, which occur every hour of every day, correct almost on-the-ground power lines, illegal by any construction code, The Alaska Energy Authority continues to ignore these pleas for corrections as if they did not exist. Only when someone is electrocuted by 115,000 volt power lines will the Alaska Energy Authority act. Not only does the legislature ignore the Alaska Energy's professional incompetence, but also condones their professional incompetence by giving the Alaska Energy Authority more work, work which will come back to the legislatures as campaign contributions.
Mr. McCutcheon, can I get you to sum up, please?
Never asked who signed the acceptance of Bradley Lake water intake. That was fraud. The legislature never asked who signed off on the power lines, but that was also fraud.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McCutcheon, could you sum up, please? I guess he summed up. We'll go on. That concludes the off-net. We have one enthusiastic participant here this afternoon that signed in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You can introduce yourself for the record and speak to the bill, please.
My name is Phil Steyer. I am the Director of Government Relations and Corporate Communications for Chugach Electric. I am here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 246. The Rail Belt, which is home to about three-fourths of Alaska's population, is electrically intertied from the Kenai Peninsula to the interior, allowing therefore power to flow from one end of the grid to the other. Today, we are heavily dependent upon natural gas from the Cook Inlet Basin for generation. Annually, about 90% of the kilowatt hours Chugach sells comes from natural gas-fired turbine generators, the other 10% from our hydroelectric projects. We would very much like to change that ratio. The electricity from the three hydro projects we have is the least expensive in the rail belt. We produce as much power as possible from them each year, but their capacity is limited. For Chugach, the cost of natural gas doubled between 2003 and 2006. Last year, the cost of natural gas accounted for about 40% of our $267 million operating budget. As the price of natural gas has gone up, so too have the bills of our customers. Affordable electric service is key to a healthy economy. Hydropower costs remain relatively flat over time, while the price of fossil fuel generation rises. At Chugach, we think the time is right to take a fresh look at the potential for an appropriately sized Susitna hydroelectric project for the rail belt. We're not trying to get in front of the study and predict whether or not a Susitna project will be feasible for the rail belt. That's the point in doing the study. We are hopeful that this review, with a focus on a project that's the right size for our region, will help us make better decisions about how we're going to provide reliable, affordable electricity for the rail belt. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Do we have any questions? Senator Thomas, do you have anything to wrap up?
No, nothing to add to it. Just I see this as a very, very very needed project. We're going to be struggling this for a long time, and I'm afraid that people are lulled to sleep again by the prospect of a gas line going through the state and supplying the power that we need, and that's not the best use, obviously, of that gas. There's a much greater potential for that to be sold and for the state to reap the benefit of the money made from that as an export item rather than consuming it in state. There obviously would be some need for it as various utilities have testified to, and obviously heating purposes and industrial expansion. There's no doubt about that, but certainly as far as simply used for production electricity, it's not certainly not the best means of generation. So hopefully we can move forward with this bill and get ourselves situated, get a good understanding of what Susitna can do for the state, particularly that 70-some percent of the population that lives within the rail belt, and obviously make some headway. So I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Senator Thomas. We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside. for now. We're going to adjourn here in a minute. Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., Senate Bill 221 again will come up. It's the capital bill. We'll continue to work on that. But before that, we'll bring back Senate Bill 289, which was the energy bill we had earlier, and move that out of committee unless there's an issue that surfaces between now and then. We'll see everybody tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., meeting adjourned.